From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Michael Heiser joins us. Ancient texts, the fate of the dead, also some UFO stories with Michael Heiser. But first, well, Wall Street received the interest rate cut it wanted, but still turned in a baffling late-day performance Wednesday, shooting higher and then skidding lower into the very last minutes of trading as some investors rushed in to cash in profits after the previous session's big advance. The major indexes ended the day mixed, with the Dow Jones Industrials falling 74 points. That's it, 74 points, only the third time in October that the blue chips had just double-digit closing. The Federal Reserve, as predicted, dropped interest rates by half a point. Regulators are working on a new federal program worth up to $600 billion. This is a new one that would provide government guarantees of home mortgages to help prevent foreclosures. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and the U.S. Treasury Department are hammering out the large foreclosure prevention program, which could provide guarantees for up to 3 million at-risk mortgages. The programs would be managed by the FDIC and would require banks, savings and loans, investment funds, hedge funds, and other mortgage holders to restructure them based on homeowners' ability to pay. Here he is, Mish Shedlock, registered investment advisor. Mish, couple questions. First of all, this $600 billion of new money, how come they didn't tell us about it when they were talking about the $700 billion?
It's really amazing. And then on top of that, the United States agreed today to loan $30 billion to the central banks of South Korea, Mexico, and two others. My screen just went dead here. But so that's another $120 billion that we're loaning other central banks because of currency crisis in Asia and Europe. So, you know, where does it stop? I mean, the monetary printing actually right now is mammoth. And people look at that and they say, my God, Mish, you're finally wrong. You were right here that this deflation is happening, but look at all this printing now. But the fact is, George, credit is still being destroyed at a faster pace, if you can imagine that, than this printing. Home values are still declining. Unemployment's rising. Credit card defaults are soaring. And Bernanke, Paulson, they just don't get it. They want banks to lend more money, and it's reckless. More money's going to go to money having over this.
So I think they've realized, Mish, that they can just, as you said, print it up and just throw it out there. They don't care.
And that's, they don't care until it actually wrecks the system here. One interesting thing happened yesterday, though. Barack Obama said that, you know, he was a little bit concerned over how they were going to fund the bailout package. And I said, my God, you know, I was almost stunned that here, and I was really worried that and they still might go nuts. And Congress is trying to do it right now based on, the news reports that are coming out here. But funding these mortgages is exactly the wrong thing to do. Unemployment's going to rise. People are going to walk away from their homes. The government's going to be stuck with the houses and the debt. We talked about that before. We need to step back, stop the bad lending, let the market bottom. Houses will be affordable. People will want to buy them. And the jobs will come back, but no, as long as the government is willing to throw money at the problem, and people are lining up for it now.
Oh, yeah, they're fighting for it.
They're fighting for it. It is truly amazing. Well, the market rallied today and then gave it off into the close. Now, I actually think that we might have put in a short-term bottom here, George. I think the market can maybe rally through the election or maybe even rally through the end of the year, but if it does, none of the problems have been addressed. We're back to the same standpoint. We're going to have one of these short covering rallies. And the interesting thing about these, we've had two 11% rallies this year.
Well, I would have expected, though, a bigger rally today after this 0.5 cut, this half a point cut. Mm-hmm. We didn't get that.
We didn't get it. The futures are up now, though, so we'll see. There might be some follow-up. But it's been over a month since the stock market has been up 2 days in a row. We've had 2 days in a row up for over over a month. I think that's unprecedented.
Happy days are here again. Mitch, thanks so much. His website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. He spells his last name if you want to search for him. S-H-E-D-L-O-C-K. I'm not sure I'd want to fly Qantas Airlines. A Qantas airliner that discovered its weather radar was faulty tailed an Air New Zealand jet across the Pacific on a flight from Los Angeles to Sydney. The Air New Zealand flight crew provided information about the weather ahead to the Qantas Boeing 747. You know, Qantas has had all kinds of problems lately, a door that blows out and some other problems. I don't know. Grapes help lower blood pressure and improve heart function in lab rats fed an otherwise salty diet, according to U.S. researchers. The findings may help people with high blood pressure. Some of the rats ate a diet containing a powder from red, green, and purple table grapes and high-salt diets. Others were fed the grape powder in a low-salt diet. The powder, which contained the same nutrients in fresh grapes, allowed the scientists to measure the rats' intake very carefully. After 18 weeks, the rats that ate the grape-enriched diet had lower blood pressure, better heart function, reduced inflammation throughout their bodies, and fewer signs of heart muscle damage than rats that ate a salty diet but no grapes. There you have it. Don't forget your glass of wine a day. The Indian Ocean tsunami in 2004 was not the first of its size to hit the region. According to new research, two international collaborations have sampled the sediments in Thailand and Sumatra to examine tsunami history at both sites. There was evidence of sediment laid down by a large tsunami between 600 and 700 years ago, predating written and oral records there. Mars may have been wet for a billion years longer than previously thought. The new water-related OPAL evidence from NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter suggests this. The findings have implications for the possibility that Mars once supported life. Scientists have known for some time that the 4.5-billion-year-old planet once harbored liquid water. But Richard C. Hoagland, head of the EnterpriseMission.com, knew even before the scientists that Mars had water. Here he is. Richard, I'm not going to say you told us so again, but here's another story that backs up what you've been saying for many, many years.
You know, this is getting almost ridiculous. It's like, how many times can NASA discover water on Mars?
I know it. It is incredible. Like, and it's older now, ancient water.
Well, you see, that's where the problem begins because, frankly, I'm going to pour some cold water on this tonight. To me, this is a total non-story, and here's why.
All right, tell me why.
When you look at Mars, when NASA, with their incredibly sophisticated spacecraft and sensors, look at Mars, and they're trying to figure out what went on down there, going back billions and billions of years, we have no ground truth. We have no rock, no piece of Mars that we can date radioactively like we can do here on Earth or we've done on the Moon. So everything they date on Mars is in terms of what they call crater counts. The presumption is that if you have an area which has lots of craters, it's older than an area that has fewer craters because in the beginning of the solar system, lots of things were banging around and colliding, and that means it's a very old surface, notwithstanding volcanism, which happened later. The problem with these dates is that what they're really going to find, ultimately, George, is that we're right. The Mars tidal model that I and, you know, Tom Van Flannert and others have been advocating for years now is the correct one, where you had a planet blow up yesterday in the solar system, spraying out all kinds of debris and shrapnel, which cratered everything in sight. So if you see a very cratered surface, in our model, it's not very, very old, it's very, very young. So if you find evidence of liquid water, and some of these new data indicate that they found evidence of liquid water amid all these craters, it means in the model of the Mars tidal explosion, you know, the planet that Mars used to orbit blew up, that it happened yesterday. It happened 65 million years ago in the model when the dinosaurs died and the whole solar system went through this huge, you know, convulsion. And so what NASA says in terms of dates, really, because they're based on a faulty underlying premise, is really not relevant. And someday, hopefully, in my lifetime, the science will move to where the real physics and the real astrophysics and the real planetology all come together, and we know what really went on Mars, because tonight NASA doesn't really seem to have a clue.
Well, good job once again, Richard. And I hear rumors that you're dressing up as a Martian on Halloween night. Is this true?
Actually, I was thinking of going to Indiana tomorrow night. Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana, is doing something really cool. They are married together with Indiana Public Radio.
Okay.
And if you go to Google, you can find Ball State University and all the links. They have actually direct URLs where you can listen in live. They are going to be reproducing Orson Welles' famed War of the Worlds script in an auditorium with a live audience with all kinds of ancient sound effects equipment from the 1930s. You know, the sound of the Martian spaceship hatch opening and all that kind of cool stuff. And it'll be a great lead-in to your Thursday night show because it's going to be in prime time. So just go to Google and Google Ball State University, War of the Worlds, and it will take you to a link, and you can have a really amazing Thursday night before Coast.
How cool is that? And also, you've got a conference coming up. Tell me about it real quickly.
Well, we have a secrets conference with Chet Snow in Phoenix, just outside of Phoenix in Scottsdale. Robin and I are going to be there. Our friend David Wilcock is going to be there, and Nick Begich, whose brother, by the way, is running for Senate from the city of Anchorage, Alaska.
Yep.
William Henry will be there. I'm going to be talking in my talks about this hyperdimensional election. I don't know whether you've noticed, George, but this is like nothing we have ever lived through. This is a tsunami. There is nothing normal about this election. And what I'm going to do after the fact is the conference is from the 21st to the 24th of November. I'm going to have enough distance to actually put some thoughts down and to project out what the next administration, the next 4 years leading up to 2012, is potentially going to reveal. And I got to tell you, this is an incredibly quintessential hyperdimensional trip.
Well, the information on the conference, of course, enterprisemission.com. Here's a phone number for those of you who do not have computers, if you're interested in going to this conference, 928-204-1962. That's 928-204-1962. Richard, you and Robin have a great Halloween. Richard C. Hoagland. Now, the White House is one of America's most haunted and famous homes, right? And stories about strange sounds, disturbing sensations, and ghostly apparitions at the White House have been part of American mythology for over a century. In a moment, paranormal expert Jeff Belanger joins us as we talk about who's haunting the White House next on Coast to Coast AM. Jeff Belanger leads a very haunted life. He's been fascinated with the supernatural since the age of 10 when he investigated his first haunted house during a sleepover. Can you imagine that, a little 10-year-old doing that? In 1999, he launched GhostVillage.com as a repository for his writings on the subject of the supernatural. And over the years, Jeffrey has interviewed hundreds of people about their experiences with the profound. His objective approach to the subject makes the supernatural accessible to all of us. And here he is now, the author of Who's Haunting the White House. Hey, Jeffrey, how are you?
Doing great, George. How are you?
Oh, good. Good to have you here, especially this time of year. One of my favorite times. You too, I bet.
Oh, man, it's busy, but, you know, I wouldn't have it any other way.
Presidential election, all kinds of things going on. Whoever gets elected, I wonder if he knows that there are ghosts in there.
Yeah, that's what it's looking like. And, you know, there's a long tradition of ghosts at the White House, as you mentioned before the break. And, you know, it's a wonderful tradition. And what a great way to look at history.
Jeffrey, let's talk a little bit about your interest in ghosts and the paranormal.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm from a young age, I grew up in an old New England town, and I had friends that were so matter-of-fact about their houses being haunted. I was just intrigued, and so would have these sleepovers and break out a Ouija board and try and make contact with whatever was in those houses. And what blew me away was that my friends weren't telling me these Hollywood ghost stories. They were telling me, yeah, this old man walks down the hall and just disappears. And as I got older, I became a journalist and writer. I worked for newspapers and magazines. And, you know, around October, you go looking for these ghost stories. And I've pretty much been hooked ever since, documenting the history, but also interviewing the eyewitnesses and getting their stories. And, you know, when you look into their eyes and you realize these people have been stirred to the core by something they've experienced, it keeps you moving on and asking a lot more questions.
You did it all right, except the Ouija board. Why'd you do that?
I was 10 years old. I mean, come on. It was right there next to Monopoly. I grabbed it.
Now, tell me about the White House and the hauntings. How long have things been going on there?
You know, the earliest reports go back to the mid-1800s and seem to be tied to the War of 1812 when the British came in and sacked Washington, burned it to the ground, including the White House. The White House was burned down. And one of the earliest reports involved a British redcoat seen out near the North Portico. Now, that figure turns up again and again, but certainly the most ghost sightings and earliest documented ghost sightings happened during the Lincoln presidency by Mary Todd Lincoln. Now, Abraham Lincoln was easily the most paranormal president, also had really the toughest time in office, if you think about it. No president ever, there's not even a close second, had a more difficult presidency than Abraham Lincoln. First of all, his young son, Willie Lincoln, died while he was president, died in the White House of a typhoid-like disease and really broke him up. Lincoln was a family man, loved his kids, loved his boys, loved to roughhouse with them, and that death really shook him to his core. In fact, he wouldn't even have Willie buried. He was kept in a crypt of a friend of his in Washington, D.C., so the president could visit the grave as often as he liked. And so, you know, really tough time. But Mary Todd Lincoln wrote in letters to her sister that Willie was visiting her at night. He would stand at the end of his bed with his Uncle Alec, who also died in infancy. And she said it gave him, you know, it gave her great joy to know that he wasn't alone in the great infinity. But you could say that maybe Mary Todd was just a distraught mother who was, you know, wanting to see her child so badly that she saw the specter, and you might dismiss that account. But it's interesting that a few decades later, in the first few years of the 1900s, a little boy's ghost shows up again at the White House, and this time in the writings of a military aide who served there, and said he was talking to some of the servants who claimed that they were spooked by a little boy's ghost in the White House. And Willie was the only little boy to die there. So very interesting that it wasn't just Mary Todd that saw this figure.
How many people, Jeff, over the years have seen ghostly apparitions in the White House? I mean, would you say it's countless?
It's impossible to put an exact number on it because some people aren't going to share those stories. Dozens, at least, dozens, including presidents, first family, including former, you know, servants, including people who have been in the White House. I mean, you know, maybe in the neighborhood of 100, I would imagine. That's just my guesstimate based on what I found and knowing that some people talk about it and some people won't.
I had heard that Lincoln, while president, had seances at the White House. Is that true?
Absolutely true. In fact, the staff of the White House will still talk about that today. We know Mary Todd Lincoln was into the seances, especially after Willie died. She was trying to make contact. And we know Abraham Lincoln attended at least one of them because he paid a bit of a political price for it. It was in the paper saying, what's this crazy president of ours doing, you know, having seances at the White House? And of course, that's happened again, right? I mean, remember Ronald Reagan's presidency when he was consulting with numerologists and astrologers.
And Nancy Reagan loved those things.
That's right. And we don't want our presidents doing anything weird, I think, is the bottom line. And when it gets out, we talk about it.
Now, when Lincoln got assassinated, were there reports of his visitations at the White House?
Yeah, well, first, Abraham Lincoln believed he was going to be assassinated. He had prophetic dreams in which he was attending
yes.
a state funeral. You know, he saw double images of himself in the mirror. So he was really by far our most paranormal president. And today he's the most prominent ghostly figure in the White House. He's shown up many times over the years, especially 1950s onward. I had trouble finding too many references to him before the 1950s, but Queen Juliana of the Netherlands was staying at the White House as a guest of Truman in 1952. She claimed she heard a knock at the door, went to open it, and there was Lincoln standing there, and the poor old queen just about passed out.
You know, Jeff, we get a lot of reports of shadow people on this mm-hmm. program, as you know, and a lot of people talk about the shadow person with a tall hat, and I'm beginning to wonder if some of these episodes are indeed the ghostly apparition of President Lincoln with that tall hat still hanging around, now he's showing up all over the place.
Yeah, you know, he's really an incredible figure from U.S. history, an important figure. If you think about what he gave to his country, I mean, he's a president during U.S. Civil War. He's got a nation tearing itself apart, thousands of Americans on both sides dying every day. And we know that took a heavy toll on him. We know he cared so deeply about his country that he pushed the war. He didn't want to see Washington's Union split.
Tell us some of the hot spots that are there, Jeffrey, when we come back. Plus, we'll open up the phone lines. Jeff Belanger, our special guest tonight, who's haunting the White House? Now, you talk about value. Two CDs of two shows, classic shows, would be about $58. The After Dark newsletter magazine is $39.95 for the year. So that's about $90, almost $100, okay? For just the After Dark magazine subscription price for a year, you'll get the After Dark magazine, and you'll get, for a limited time, two CDs of an Art Bell interview with the late Father Malachi Martin. Now, you may own one of them because we did this a long time ago, but only one CD. Now we have two separate CDs that we're giving you free, a little shipping and handling, that's it, when you subscribe to the After Dark magazine. Call 1-888-727-5505. You can go online, coasttocoastam.com. Renewals, you'll get the two CDs as well. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest tonight, Jeff Belanger, who's haunting the White House. This is his latest work. Where are some of the hot spots in the White House, Jeffrey?
Well, George, there's plenty, but if you have to talk about the hottest hotspot, it's the Lincoln bedroom, which, of course, was never his bedroom. It was actually the executive office before they added on the east and west wings. But there is some furniture in that room that was owned by the Lincolns. Now, the reports go back, as I mentioned earlier, Queen Juliana, but other staff have seen flickering lights. We know Jimmy Carter's daughter, Amy, allegedly broke out a Ouija board and tried to hold a seance in there. And also, in recent years, a staff member went upstairs on the second floor. His job was to turn on the lights in the morning, first thing. And as he's going down the hall, he's turning on the lights, and right outside of the bedroom, he sees Lincoln sitting in a chair, legs crossed, arms folded, looks right at him, and then disappears. So that's a very modern-day account. And actually, you can hear the words from the witness's mouth on the White House official website, which is whitehouse.gov/ghosts. So you could call that some federal recognition, because that's our tax dollars buying those, that website. So maybe that's some federal recognition of ghosts.
What about animal hauntings at the White House? Because most presidential folks, you know, families, had animals, had pets.
Yeah, that's right. There is one legend I came across, a black cat that's said to haunt the basement. And if you see it, it's supposed to be a harbinger of bad things to come for the country. So if this black cat is, you know, said to be down there lurking only when bad things are happening in the nation.
Let's take a few calls while we continue chatting. John in Cincinnati, Ohio, east of the Rockies. Hi, John.
Hi, Jeff, George. I was just calling. I just recently had a bunch of books handed down to me, and I heard your program about Lincoln and stuff, and this book's called Strangers Among Us by Ruth Montgomery, and she indicated that Lincoln was a walk-in, and I didn't know if anybody, if you knew anything about that, Jeff.
About being a walk-in?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with that term.
Well, walk-in is basically, I guess, when a person, instead of, like, committing suicide, and what really drew my attention to it was that how Lincoln's son died.
Right.
And when people kind of give up on life, and they, instead of committing suicide, they permit a higher-level entity into their body.
Oh,
yeah. And she indicated that he was one of them. And I just thought it was really interesting how Lincoln's son died and how deeply affected he was by it. And then I guess after that, all of the a lot of the change came into play.
Well, you know, Lincoln throughout his life, even before he was president, he didn't have the easiest life. I mean, humble beginnings, sure, but definitely some bouts with depression, even before, you know, getting into politics, things he had to deal with. And, I mean, imagine what this president went through, not only losing his son, but a nation at war with itself. I can't believe that there was a spare, you know, spare atom in his mind that was available for anything other than focusing on the job, focusing on his family. I really admire this president above many, many others. I couldn't comment either way, but I do think that this was a busy guy and a focused guy trying to keep the nation together. So I don't know if he'd have room for another entity in there.
Are children who visit the White House, do they see any of these apparitions too? Because they're pretty receptive.
Yeah, well, you know what's interesting is that, you know, there've been plenty of kids that live there in the first families, and we know Amy Carter, anyway, you know, would pull pranks related to the hauntings and things like that, people know about the ghosts there. There's no question. There's no question that Obama and McCain have heard about it. I mean, Hillary Clinton even acknowledged it in a kind of a slight way during an interview a few years ago. I think children are more sensitive. And imagine living there. I mean, seriously, I can't imagine being president. You live in a fishbowl. You've got everybody looking in, security everywhere. You can't just go outside and go for a walk if you want to. So it's got to be a tough environment for a kid. And I'm sure they make every effort to make it as normal as they can, especially in the upper floors, which are the private residence of the first family. But, yeah, kids are sensitive, and rightfully so. The media doesn't get a lot of access to the kids of the White House. But, boy, you know, I do think some of them are experiencing things there, and you just wish once they get out that they'd come forward and share a little more of those stories.
West of the Rockies in Las Vegas, Kyle, you're up with us. Hi, Kyle, go ahead.
Hey, good evening, guys. Thank you for letting me be on the air.
Absolutely.
I have three quick questions. Off the Lincoln subject, you said there was a guy that you were interviewing earlier, and he said that he was going to hyperdimensional. He was talking about the hyperdimensional resonator.
Well, that's Richard Hoagland, yeah.
Does he know Steve Gibbs?
Yeah, he's heard of Steve Gibbs. I'm not sure he's met him.
Because I was curious about the time travel thing. But, okay, I wanted to know about the apparitions in the White House. Are any of them violent or threatening?
Okay, and what's your other question?
My other question is, did you ever hear of like a stupid cartoon called The Venture Brothers, and they ended up spending the night at the White House, and they end up meeting the ghost of Abraham Lincoln?
Yes, that's Beavis and wasn't that from Beavis and Head? I think it was.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I did. That's a hilarious scheme. But as far as violence within the White House with apparitions.
There is one. I mean, I wouldn't call it violent, but I would say that Mary Todd Lincoln did report hearing Andrew Jackson's angry ghost swearing and cursing and throwing a fit in the Rose guest room, which was the former president's bedroom. So I think Old Hickory was about as violent as it got.
The Beavis scene, by the way, Jeffrey, was absolutely hilarious if you're into cartoons. That I shall not repeat. Let's go to Bedford, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air with us. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi, yeah, I was also wondering kind of along the same lines for a question. Thank you for having me on the air.
Sure.
First time. It's like one of those miracle things. I don't know. I was wondering if, like, within the White House they had any, I guess they're going to say whispers or, like, dark end, just like a mist, black mist in the corner of a room. Say anything?
Yeah, you know, I didn't hear any accounts of anything.
Children?
Right, yeah. When I was there and the people I talked to didn't have any accounts of anything dark like that. And what I got repeatedly from various staff, including the boss there, the chief usher, was that there seems to just be an historic sense to some of the entities and some of the spirits that are still lingering there. And when you stand in that building, when you're near the North Portico and you're in the main hall and you realize every single president stood where you're standing at one point in time. I mean, it's powerful. You pick up on that. I mean, you might call it a residual haunting that you're picking up on, but more than that, I mean, it's the essence of America itself. I can't recommend it enough. If you get the opportunity to go in the White House, you should. If you're an American, you're part owner of that building, and it's woven with the fabric of history. And so there's not a lot of these reports about, you know, poltergeists or dark mists or anything like that. There's reports about historic figures that still are lingering around. Presidents have reported drawing strength from. I remember seeing an interview with George Bush the senior talking about how he had to send some troops into a military action, and he just drew some strength, knowing that what Lincoln went through was so much harder. And so maybe these presidents call up the former presidents because they still need them. You know, because we still need their strength and wisdom in our modern times.
What are you doing on Halloween, Jeff?
Oh, man, we got strobe lights, fog machines, full-size candy bars. By by noon on Halloween, I call it quits with everything, and I just enjoy the day and go deck out the house and play the music and have fun with it again.
Yeah, good for you. First-time caller line. Let's go to you, Charlie, in Philadelphia. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, George. How you doing?
Good. Thank you.
I love your show.
Thank you.
I got a question for both you and Jeff. Jeff, have you ever heard of a place in Philadelphia called the Bellroy? Some consider it to be the most haunted house in America.
No, I don't know that one. I'd love to know.
Actually, it's there was an article written by someone. In fact, George, you might even know him, a fellow by the name of Charles Adams.
Oh, yes. I know Charlie Adams, sure.
Yeah, he's part of the Philadelphia Ghost Hunters Alliance. Mm-hmm. Subsequently, this house was owned by General George Meade, who fought under, in the Battle of Gettysburg.
Sure.
And he was also, he designed the Barnegat Light down in Long Beach Island, New Jersey. Some consider this house to be the most haunted in America. I was just curious if you or George ever heard of it.
I have not. How about you, Jeff?
No, I'm afraid I haven't. I sure know Charles J. Adams III, though. Great guy, great researcher. I'll have to look into that.
Yeah, it actually, there's a website you can go on to for the Philadelphia Ghost Hunters Alliance. And it's in one of his books, too, Philadelphia Ghost Stories.
Great.
Okay, great.
Thanks,
bro. Thought I'd ask.
Okay.
You.
Appreciate you being on the show. Thanks, Charlie. Driving around in Philly. Let's go to east of the Rockies in Jupiter, Florida. Hey, Tom, you're on the air with us. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. I just had a real quick question for you. I'm a conduit. I don't know if you've ever heard of what a conduit is.
Well, you draw this to you, whatever it is?
I can draw spirits into me, and walking has a different meaning for me, where spirits will actually walk into me to talk to other people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was wondering, you know, being as I am, being able to draw these things into me and have them just step on in and go, hey, I want to talk to you. Is it wise for me to go to such places as the White House or as the building that the gentleman earlier was talking about in Philly?
Boy, I think, you know, if it's something that you feel safe doing, would love to get you to the White House. You know, would love to, you know, these historic figures, if they are coming through, boy, as a historian and a researcher and a writer, I want to know what they have to say. But George, by all means, jump in here. But if you have to feel comfortable and feel safe in doing what you're doing.
Well, that's true. You do. I think it's okay for you to go, Tom.
All right, thank you, gentlemen.
That's my take. Jeffrey, of everything that you've investigated to date, have you come across people like this who seem to, they're like magnets to apparitions?
Yeah, there's definitely people that are more sensitive to it and people that seem to have more than their share of experiences throughout the years. And I think some people, you know, learn to identify it early, and we might call those people sensitives or psychics or mediums. Others just kind of live with it and wonder why they're seeing things that other people aren't. But, yeah, some of us are. I don't consider myself too sensitive. I've only had a couple of experiences over the years and being in a lot of creepy places and a lot of haunted places all over the world. But other people... are tuning in.
Next up, let's go to Detroit, Michigan, old hometown. Hey, Brian, go ahead.
Hello.
How's things in Motown?
Hey, they're pretty good. How you doing?
Good, Brian. Go ahead.
Well, what I called in about is I was a little kid in Greenfield Village. My brother, we went into a Greenfield Village, and he is convinced that in the past life he was Abraham Lincoln. And when we went into the house, he knew where everything was going to be at. He described everything. It was something I'll never forget. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of that or what.
Yeah, you know, people claim to be reincarnations of past historical figures often. And I think, you know, Lincoln is such a prominent figure in our collective psyche. You know, I mean, we learn about him when we're school kids. He just comes up again and again. He's on our money. You can't get away from him. You know, you pull out a $5 bill and you're reminded. You know, maybe we all pick up on that in to certain degrees, or maybe there's something to it. Maybe your brother has some connection that's a little closer than we know.
Yeah.
Hey, tell me about the British Redcoat soldier that was out there standing in front of the area there.
Yeah, when I was in there, I was talking to a Secret Service agent, and these guys know every detail about the building. They can tell you the carpet, the paintings, the busts, everything. And I said, well, what do you know about the ghosts? And he said, well, you know, there's a British Redcoat that's been seen out near the North Portico. And again, you know, this one of put that in quotes, reminders of the past. In 1814, the building was burned to the ground when the British sacked Washington, D.C. They rebuilt, they repainted the White House, but there's two spots that they never painted. There's a window on the south side near the Truman Balcony that still bears the burn marks, and there's a window near the North Portico, kind of near where the British redcoat's been seen, that still shows the burn marks. It was important that, that people never forget what took place there. And I think that, that British redcoat, again, serves as a reminder to all of us that, hey, we have been vulnerable in the past. Bad things can happen, and you can't always let your guard down.
Amazing. It started building it in 1792. Can you believe that? So it must be haunted.
Oh, right, 1792. It was completed in 1800, November 1st, 1800. John and Abigail Adams were the first two to actually live there, and there was no furniture when they moved in, nothing. And so there was no money for that. And Abigail Adams made the most of the East Room. She used it to hang her laundry. Why you go outside and face the elements?
Tell me a little bit about this website that you've got here for kids.
Yeah, in correlation, this is a kid's book that I put out. The idea is to use ghosts as an innovative way to teach history, just one of the many ways that we can use spirits and ghosts. And kids.ghostvillage.com was launched as a resource for parents who want to talk about ghosts with their kids, as for educators who want to use ghosts in the classroom, either as a way to teach history or a way to teach storytelling and writing, things like that. And it's a place for kids to be junior ghost hunters, learn some tips and tricks, the how-tos, and how families can do this together and talk about it.
All right, next up, Chuck, let's go to you, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Chuck.
Yes. Jeff, I wondered if you knew anything about the Racco House in Sonora, California.
No, I'm not familiar with that one. What's that one about?
Well, he was the founder of Sonora, or one of them,
mm-hmm.
and he had a home out on, it's Algerine Road, and it was out in the country, of course, and it was a stage stop, and they held funerals there when the local people died, and it also was a grocery store in that home. Well, I had the occasion of staying there one time, my brother-in-law and I was downstairs, and the woman that was a descendant of his said, Chuck, you collect coins. You go upstairs in the first bedroom to the right or left. Up on top of the dresser, there's a little coin purse made in the shape of a soldier's hat. He said, you get that. It's got some older coins in it. So we went up the staircase and threw back the door, the sliding door. Stairs were about 5 foot wide going up. And threw it back, and out comes this apparition of that bedroom that I was supposed to go in. He was, it was a man, and it was kind of an orangish-white apparition, and he went straight down the hall and turned it into a bedroom at the very end, and my hair stood up, and it does right now thinking about that. I was only about 5 feet from him at the time, and I looked at my brother-in-law. He looked at me, and but anyhow, we ran down there and turned in that bedroom, and it was all bedrooms up there, and turned in there, and all there was an old iron bed with springs on it, and a dresser, and I'm sure he was in there, but he wasn't showing himself. So,
all right, Chuck, we're gonna take this break, and Jeffrey, I want to thank you for being on the program, and happy haunting, Jeff Bullinger. We'll be back in a moment with Michael Heiser on Coast to Coast AM.